system on a residence or commercial building. The production tax credit for wind is 1.8 cents for every kilowatt hour generated. These credits are critical because they ensure that if oil prices slip back down again, which can easily happen, even from these current heights, investments in wind and solar power will still be profitable. That's how you launch a new energy technology and help it go to scale so it can eventually compete without subsidies. It is a cruel joke the way Congress and the Bush administration count pennies when it comes to building new industries, as if the money for wind, solar, and biomass were coming out of their own children's piggy banks. And yet, they throw money out the window, like a house full of drunken sailors, when it comes to the old, established, well-capitalized oil, coal, and gas industries, let alone the agriculture lobby. By the time Hot, Flat, and Crowded went to press in July 2008, the tax incentives for wind and solar had not passed. They were defeated primarily by Senate Republicans who were interested only in promoting more nuclear energy and more domestic oil drilling. As investors in these areas will tell you, short-term tax credit extensions can have very harmful effects on emerging industries which are trying to attract patient capital to scale up manufacturing, system assembly, and delivery of equipment and services. These are large projects that require big, long-term investments, and therefore a long-term, stable tax structure, like the one enjoyed by the oil and gas industry, which still receives tax incentives that were put into place decades ago. Michael Polsky, founder of Invenergy, one of the biggest wind developers in America, says Congress has no appreciation of the impact it has on a company such as his when it fails to extend the production tax credit on wind. "It's a disaster," says Polsky. "Wind is a very capital-intensive industry, and financial institutions are not ready to take congressional risk. They say, if you don't get the production tax credit, we will not lend you the money to buy turbines and build projects." Over the last 50 years, tens of billions of dollars in subsidies, which never expire, have been extended to the fossil fuel and nuclear industries. A scathing report by the Cato Institute, entitled "Oil Subsidies in the Dock," January 17, 2007, listed a few of the tax breaks given just to the oil and gas industry. They include preferential tax treatment for afforded intangible domestic drilling expenses, primarily labor and material costs associated with finding and exploiting oil and gas fields, the accelerated depletion allowance provided to small oil producers, preferential expensing for equipment used to refine liquid fuels, accelerated depreciation for natural gas distribution pipelines, accelerated depreciation for expenditures on dry holes, and the exemption from passive loss limitation for owners of working interests in oil and gas properties. Don't understand all this mumbo-jumbo? Neither do I. But you can bet that the lobbyists who crafted these tax breaks know exactly, to the penny, how much they are worth to ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. "It is really sad," says Roan Resch, president of the Solar Energy Industries Association, "that the United States has reached a point where the priorities of Congress could become so distorted by politics that Washington would turn its back on the next great global industry, clean power." A study by Navigant Consulting found that if the wind and solar credits were allowed to expire at the end of fiscal year 2008, the impact in 2009 would be thousands of jobs either lost or not created in these industries, and billions of dollars of investments that won't be made. Eventually, Congress will slap something together, but it probably won't be the kind of long-term credits America's renewable industries need if they are going to scale and become global players. Japan's solar investment tax credits are guaranteed for 12 years, and Germany's for 20. In 1997, said Resch, America was the leader in solar energy technology with 40% of global solar production. Last year we were less than 8%, and even most of that was manufacturing for overseas markets. When I spoke with Resch in April 2008, he told me about a conversation he'd just had with a European solar manufacturer who was looking to outsource production of his solar panels to America. They would do all the innovation in Europe, he said, but would do the blue-collar assembly in America, where the cheap dollar had made everything half price for companies with foreign currency to spend. He told me, said Resch, you are the new India. It sent a chill down my spine. When our energy policy is not being undermined by greed, the sheer ambivalence and negligence of our own leaders does the job just fine. During the congressional budget process for fiscal year 2008, the struggle between Republicans and Democrats over funding resulted in all the painstaking spending allocations made by the House and Senate Appropriations Committees getting thrown out at the last minute in favor of a single omnibus appropriations bill to keep the government running. These boring details matter. In fact, they tell a very important story. The largest batch of funds for supporting transformational energy innovation at our universities and national labs comes from the Department of Energy's Office of Science. These funds are annually provided through something called the Energy and Water Development Appropriations Bill, which funds both DOE and Army Corps of Engineers water projects. But when Congress opted for just a general throw-everything-in-one-pot omnibus appropriations bill, most of the increase in funding that was slated to go to the DOE's Office of Science, much of it for vital energy research and innovation, got diverted to water projects, which all members of Congress have in their districts and about which they get to issue press releases. These include flood control projects, port dredging, dams, levees, the kind of projects that have been in the budget since Mark Twain's time. So money that would have given a nice and necessary boost to advanced energy research went instead to water pork. This was Congress fiddling, not the president. Specifically, the final fiscal year 2008 omnibus appropriations for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was $5.6 billion, $700 million above the president's request of $4.9 billion. That increase came while the DOE's Office of Science, our nation's primary funder of transformational advances in physical science, material science, high-energy physics, chemistry, biosciences, geosciences, astrophysics, fusion, particle physics, and nuclear physics, ended up with an appropriation of approximately $4 billion, roughly $400 million less than the president had requested, and, after inflation, a net increase of about zero from the year before. At a time when every negative energy trend is accelerating, CO2 in the atmosphere, demand for oil and gas, climate change, and petro-dictatorship, our spending on advanced energy research went flat. But don't worry, your local port got a good dredging, so deeper-hulled oil tankers and container ships from China can bring more of their exports to our shores. What difference does $400 million make? Ask Paul Olivisatos, the deputy director of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and co-leader of the Helios Project, LBNL's Solar Energy Research Initiative. His team is working on a potential breakthrough that could enable humans to create artificial photosynthesis so people wouldn't need plants to convert sunlight to food and fuel. He is considered one of America's top nanotechnology scientists at one of its premier labs. LBNL went through an almost 4-year process to get the project funded. It asked for $15 million. DOE was able to commit $10 million, and by the time Congress got done fiddling, it ended up at $5 million. To be fair, no one knew they were shrinking this program. It just happened in the course of how our leaders do business. That is, with no one thinking in terms of a grand energy strategy. Congress, no doubt spurred on by the agriculture lobby, did fully fund the Office of Science's 3 bioenergy research centers, one of which LBNL manages, which are charged with finding new advanced biofuels. Biofuels that work with current infrastructure and don't compete with food crops. For all the talk in magazines and by politicians about the energy issue, if you look at our walk and not at our talk, you would have to conclude that the United States has no sense of urgency when it comes to energy research. It's as if Sputnik has gone up, the nation has been challenged again to reinvent itself, this time in regard to energy, but we're sleepwalking into the future, still quietly hoping that it's all just a bad dream from which we'll soon wake up again, able to fill our tanks with dollar-a-gallon gasoline and drive off with green stamps and a set of NFL logo glasses. We need to get back to basics. Government's job is to seed the research that will produce the sorts of fundamental breakthroughs in chemistry, material science, biology, physics, and nanotechnology that open the way for whole new approaches to solving energy problems. Approaches that create new building blocks for energy and easier ways for innovators to put them together. Venture capitalists can then pick off the most promising ideas and try to commercialize them. But to find one really good idea, a green Google, you need thousands of scientists and postdocs experimenting with different options. That is what basic research funding is for, explained Nate Lewis of Caltech. Basic energy science asks the question, how do we make new things out of new materials in new ways? What we try to establish in our labs is the fundamental science engineering that says, here is a new way to do it. It can be done. Then the venture capitalists come in and put up money to see if it can be done cheaply and at scale. Often it can't. But you need the pre-competitive research to seed this garden, he said. You need to fund 100 ideas because you know 99 are not going to work and one will be the next Google. When someone asked Linus Pauling, the 2-time Nobel laureate, why he has so many good ideas, he answered, because I have a lot of ideas. No one should be under any illusion that the venture capital community can replace massive government funding at the level of basic scientific research. The venture capitalist's job is to pick the flowers that are blooming and see if he or she can transplant them into crops that can scale. But if no one is planting seeds to get those flowers, there will not be much to pick from. The reason there's a shortage of VC investing in green is because there's been a shortage of federal funding from the Department of Energy in renewable research, said John Doerr, one of the country's most successful venture capitalists, who, with his partners at the legendary firm Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield & Byers, helped launch Google, Amazon, Sun, and Netscape. With few exceptions, Doerr said, VCs don't, knowingly, fund basic research, though at Kleiner Perkins we've done so accidentally on occasions. There's a shortage, a tremendous need for investment-worthy projects. More than ever before, we're crawling labs around the world, developing our own knowledge maps of opportunities. Even an extra $1 billion to $2 billion investment by the federal government in basic science research could make an enormous difference. The amount of money going into this area for research is a fraction of what is needed, said Alivisatos. These days, if you meet a student working in chemistry, physics, or biology, and you tell them you want them to work on a solar energy project, their eyes light up. This is what they really want to work on. There are thousands of students who want to work on this problem, but we cannot find the fellowships to support and enable them to do the work that is needed. But what about those who say scientists always want more funding and always complain the government isn't supporting enough research? There can be some truth to that statement, and sometimes it is hard to prioritize, and we're an entrepreneurial bunch, said Olivisatos. But let's just remember what happened in the latest budget cycle. 700 research proposals for working on solar energy were turned down for fiscal 2008. The Department of Energy put out a call for proposals. The response was overwhelming. Scientists all over the U.S. responded with research proposals, and the money did not materialize. The DOE is really trying. They thought they would have $35 million to spend on basic solar research. We got $5 million for our project, and we were one of the few to get funded. Think about that potential. Think about how many scientists and how many postdoc students were ready to work on this problem, and they were all basically turned away. Thousands of scientists who want to work on the energy problem are not able to work on it today. Numbers matter, because we need to be thinking about energy innovation in a much more strategic way than we have in the past, explained Steve Chu, the Nobel laureate who runs the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Chu has revamped the energy research at the lab, breaking down all the traditional silos between physics, biology, material science, chemistry, and nanotechnology, and merging experts in each of these fields into collaborative teams, where each specialty can nurture the other. In his view, the real breakthroughs are going to be found in the intersections of all these specialties, so you want a lot of people in a lot of disciplines working on this problem. We need to be supporting the energy research community more broadly, but we also need to be focusing on a few large-scale research centers which have critical mass, where there are enough different scientists working a lot of different projects, so you have lots of different possibilities for collaboration, said Chu. When I joined Bell Labs as a young scientist, it was a life-changing experience. You walked into a building with thousands of world-class scientists working in teams on the same problem. While much of the innovative research will come from our universities, we need a few places with that amount of intellectual firepower working the energy problem under one roof. This problem doesn't have a simple solution. We have not found the answers yet. What makes me really optimistic, though, Chu told me, is when I go and hang out with my own students and talk to students all around the country. They want to work on this problem. They see that the energy problem has become both a national and international crisis and want to join up to solve it. Sadly, with the almost flat funding in basic energy research, our students are lining up to enlist, but the recruiting stations remain closed. If you add all the federal dollars going into energy research together, and that would include research on oil, gas, and coal, as well as solar, said Daniel M. Kamen, the University of California, Berkeley energy policy expert, it would total around $3 billion in government money and about $5 billion in private sector and venture funds, which is about 9 days of fighting in Iraq. Energy is a $1 trillion a year industry, and that means reinvesting about $8 billion in R&D constitutes 0.8% of revenues. But even that paltry 0.8% of revenues going into energy R&D has gone up and down like a roller coaster since the first oil shock in the 1970s, added Kamen, and this has wrought havoc on the energy research world. No researcher can build a lab and hire the best graduate students when the money is going up and down every year. A really good student would be dumb to work in this area, as opposed to biotech or information technology, where they know resources will be there to finish their projects, and where they can also be assured to get a job afterward. Compare this with healthcare, said Cannon. The national health budget went through a planned expansion that from 1982 to 1990 essentially doubled the budget of the National Institutes of Health. The NIH budget has stayed high ever since, so it is possible, and there wasn't even a specific healthcare crisis. When the federal budget in that area increased, the private sector R&D budget went up by a factor of 14 to 15, said Cannon, which changed the whole landscape. Business saw that we were serious, and they invested. And now we tout our biotech revolution as a great success. We have not applied that strategy to energy. Jeffrey Immelt of GE, which has a huge healthcare equipment business, estimates that the difference in R&D spending between the healthcare and energy industries over the last 20 years has been about $50 billion in favor of healthcare. To look at the problem historically, as of 2003, nuclear energy had received 56% of total energy research and development funding from the Department of Energy since 1948. Fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, had received 24% of the total, renewable energy 11%, and energy efficiency 9%, according to the Congressional Research Service study, Renewable Energy, published on May 25, 2005. The only silver lining when you compare how much we are investing in healthcare research to how little we are investing in energy research, said Joseph Rahm, who served as a senior official in the Department of Energy during the Clinton administration, is this. At least people will live long enough to see how badly we've screwed things up. To be sure, when our leadership did make a significant investment in energy, upping the federal research budget $2.5 billion to over $6 billion from 1977 to 1980, some programs got funded that were not that great, said Cannon. You don't always make the right bets, but there have been some spectacular successes. Solar energy science and technology advanced in leaps and bounds as a result of that money. Much of the solar energy technology being deployed today in what has been a boom in the industry was developed during that period. But the flip side of our lack of steadfastness has been that many of these innovations went into American companies that, lacking domestic market support, were eventually bought by Japanese or European solar companies. So, American taxpayers, in effect, ended up funding other countries' R&D. How could this happen? Ever since 1945, the U.S. economy has had to reinvent itself every 10 to 15 years to keep jobs growing, said Cannon. Big new job growth comes from waves of technological innovation, like IT and biotech. The next boom in technology is going to be clean energy, but it just has not penetrated through our macroeconomic policy analysis. Higher economic growth goes to the places that innovate. If you are not building these new clean power technologies for export, you are losing out on the next big economic boom, no matter what you say. India and China and Indonesia are all installing new power plants today. We need to be selling them the next generation, solar, wind, solar thermal, geothermal, and other cutting-edge technologies, which we have an advantage in designing and building. But we are not rising to that opportunity. We are not going to remake a $1 trillion energy industry in one generation by spending less than 1% of revenues on R&D when the norm in other industries is 8 to 10%. Oh well, I guess we'll just have to get to it when we get to it. In case you don't think this attitude has consequences, let me tell you the story of First Solar Inc., probably America's premier solar company. Warning, this story will make you cry. First Solar started in Toledo, Ohio. Unlike firms that use silicon to make solar cells, First Solar generates electricity from thin films of cadmium telluride, a semiconductor made from cadmium and tellurium coated onto glass. These cadmium telluride solar cells are currently not as efficient as silicon solar cells, but they are cheaper and can operate in more varied climates and light conditions, and they easily blend into a building's facade. The company's CEO, Mike Ahern, picks up the story. "We started in 1992, said Ahern, when a small group of scientists and engineers came together to develop a technology that could deposit thin films of semiconductor material onto sheets of glass, much like flat panel TV screens, and process these sheets into solar panels capable of absorbing sunlight and converting it to electricity. Their dream was to dramatically reduce the cost of solar electricity to the point that it could be used to meet much of the daytime electricity needs of the industrialized world and begin providing affordable power to the millions of people on our planet who live today with little or no electricity. For 12 years, our associates struggled to transform patented technology into a workable manufacturing process, enduring technical failures, funding crises, employee attrition, and a host of other startup problems along the way. When it looked like we were going to have to shut down because of a lack of funds, John Walton, of the Walton Walmart family fortune, who was a First Solar investor, stuck by us through some really difficult times as we perfected the process. It wasn't until late 2004, after a total investment of over $150 million, that the first small manufacturing line became fully operational. This factory line, using a lot of machinery that First Solar initially designed and built on its own, can stamp very high volumes of solar cells and can be replicated anywhere in the world. Not an easy trick in the solar business. During the 3 years since completing that first manufacturing line, we've increased our annual production rate by over 800% to become one of the largest solar module manufacturers in the world, said Ahern. Our annual revenues have grown from over $6 million to over $500 million by the end of 2007, and we've cut the cost of solar modules from nearly $3 per watt in 2004 to $1.12 per watt as of the end of 2007, which brings our founding vision into range and shows you the power of combining semiconductor technology with production scale. In November 2007, we became a public company and today have a market capitalization approaching $20 billion. When I was discussing this story with a friend, he remarked, "Only in America." And it's true that our story at first glance does seem to have many of the hallmarks of the classic American dream. But, in fact, First Solar is, to a large extent, a German success story. How could that be? In 2003, explained Ahern, we began initial production and we started looking around for markets that would give us the scale that we needed, that would drive big volumes so we could get more efficient. At the time, Japan had the world's first solar incentive program, dating to around 1990, based on residential systems. It was a highly coordinated effort by the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, which had promoted Sharp and Kyocera and Sanyo and Mitsubishi to be the leaders of the global solar market. And Sharp had a dominant share of the Japanese market. You could see how they got their supply chain, production, and distribution channels all forged into an efficient, scalable model that made them the low-cost solar manufacturer in the industry. That Japanese market was bigger than the rest of the world combined, and of course was effectively closed to non-Japanese companies. So we said, we need our Japan if we are going to expand and reduce costs, said Ahern. Where are we going to find a sponsor to scale us up? Here we had invented this incredible technology. It is starting to look like it is going to work, and our scientists and engineers are saying to me, where are we going to find a market for 25 megawatts? Which was our annual production target. And I just kept telling them, you solve the technical problems, we'll sell the product. But then I started looking around and asking myself, where are we going to sell this? We needed to find a way to get high volumes of our product into the marketplace cost-effectively so that we could begin to drive the price to the levels we think are needed to open large markets close to the average U.S. retail energy price, which was 8 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That meant that we had to eventually sell our solar panel at $1 to $1.25 per watt. At the time, in 2003, our manufacturing costs were over $3 per watt, so we had a long way to go. We really needed somewhere to get some volume going. Naturally, this American company, headquartered in Arizona and with its main factory in Ohio, wanted to exploit the American solar market. The problem was, there was no American solar market, and no one in Washington or anywhere else was particularly interested in creating one, even though jobs in the solar industry are pure manufacturing jobs. You don't mine, you don't strip, you don't dig, you don't drill. You just build stuff while wearing a blue collar. We came to Washington and then went to many states in the Southwest, Ahern recalled. We said to a couple of American utilities, we will lose money to just get going, because we knew that as we scaled, the costs would go down, and we still could not get any takers. At that time, we had 100 employees. We talked to Arizona and Ohio congressmen. They were all opposed to taxpayer subsidies. We did not get a lot of traction. With the backing of John Walton, we told them, we'll take the risks. Just tell us you'll buy the power. We got lower-level guys who would agree, but by the time it worked up to the top, it got nowhere. That was when we decided to go to Germany. In 1990, explained Ahern, the year of reunification, the German government had created and passed the first feed-in law for solar electricity. The feed-in law is a demand incentive program that has been widely copied by countries outside the U.S. and expanded within Germany to make Germany the world's largest market for solar products. It started small, but in 2004, the Germans said to themselves, how do we really engage the private sector to get some scale in financing and real investment in technology and equipment? They decided to go all the way to the end user, the home or the business, and say to them, what level of feed-in tariff would make you just jump into this? So in 2004, they changed their feed-in rates. They told every German consumer, if you build a solar system on your home or office or farmland or landfills, if you build a system anywhere, the local utility has to interconnect it and pay you for the kilowatt hours your solar system feeds into the grid at a price fixed by national law for 20 years. For 20 years! That is a no-brainer. Every year, and this was really smart, new solar projects coming online in Germany have a feed-in tariff that is 5% lower than the previous year's tariff to account for and to stimulate improvements in efficiency. Research around learning curves says that when sales double, you usually get a roughly 20% reduction in price. So volume matters here. The more volume, the quicker and further you move down the learning curve toward the price that will scale in China and India. After we made the initial market test in Germany, we realized that the feed-in program will create a market that will allow us to scale. Also, we realized that their program had created a center of technological excellence with a lot of budding innovators, said Ahern. So we ended up employing or partnering with a number of these German scientists and engineers, and their contributions have been critical to our success. Today, we purchase over half of the equipment used in our production lines from German manufacturers and count suppliers in Eastern Germany as among our most important business partners. Meanwhile, back home, the American market was totally fragmented. You could not imagine scaling a business here, said Ahern. Not only had Germany created its own surge in demand in 2004 that got us launched, but Spain, Italy, France, Greece, and Portugal all adopted very similar feed-in tariff markets. And this produced a big inflow of capital into the whole value chain across Europe. Unlike in America, where government incentive programs stop and start every couple of years, and you never know when the subsidies might come on and off, the German program has no time limits, and the incentives on existing solar generation products are guaranteed for at least 20 years. So there was no cliff hanging out there. We had our original production line in Ohio, and then added two more, and then we had to build our next plant. Where should we put it? We decided to build it in Eastern Germany, in the city of Frankfurt-Oder, 540 jobs, good-paying jobs. We knew if we built a factory that comes online in 2 years in Germany, that the market would still be there. If you built it somewhere in the United States, you could not be sure of that. Then we went to our German customers and signed long-term contracts with progressive pricing, so we knew we could repay the plant investment. You could plan your whole cash flow. Because the German market was so developed, thanks to the feed-in law, a broad network developed there of solar distributors and system integrators with strong technical abilities who could help us bring the new product to market efficiently, said Ahern. We formed a German sales and marketing subsidiary and built a sales and technical support team in Mainz that today serves as our global sales and marketing base. We continue to generate well over half of our revenues from Germany. In fact, the 800% increase in production that I mentioned comes predominantly from our factory in Frankfurt-Oder. It is the largest thin-film solar factory in the world and represents one of the largest foreign direct investments ever made in the solar industry. That factory could have and should have been built in Ohio, but we wanted to be close to our business partners and demonstrate to the German government that we were prepared to provide an economic return to the region based on the investment that the government made in creating the market, said Ahern. Also, Eastern Germany is a good place to manufacture. It possesses well-trained people, good manufacturing infrastructure, a stable economy, and good social and political infrastructures. We were also able to obtain financial incentives provided by the European Union and the German government. The German government gave us a shot, and we thought we needed to demonstrate a payback to them. They took the first step and wrote a check to validate our theory. So, we made ourselves a German company. The world, most of the world, took notice, Ahern told me. Countries all over the world are now contacting us to build our next factory there. But so far, no one has called from the U.S. Between 2006 and 2008, First Solar's market capitalization went from $1.5 billion to $20 billion. You would think that would get the attention of Ohio's lawmakers, but it didn't. When the 2007 energy bill came up for debate, and the question was whether or not to include a national renewable energy portfolio standard, which would have really grown the U.S. market for solar, and to extend the investment tax credit of 30% for building solar energy, Ohio's Republican Senator, George Voinovich, voted against both. No Michigan lawmaker would ever dare vote against the car companies that have been swimming in red ink and laying off workers for years. but when it comes to launching a whole new industry that is creating real jobs, big profits, and new technologies, Republican senators from solar states do not hesitate to vote with their party and against the real interests of critically important local companies. "What did those senators tell you?" I asked Ahern. "What we have consistently heard," he answered, "is that there is a lot of support for renewable energy, but it just got caught up in political maneuvering. At a minimum, there is a leadership void where this kind of petty politics can stand in the way of launching a whole new industry." I understand politics. I am not naive. But I also understand a crisis and an opportunity. As my friend, the former Stanford economist Paul Romer, likes to say, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. But we are well on our way. Are you crying yet? Blowin' in the Wind. When we aren't shooting ourselves in both feet, the simple fact remains that remaking our dirty fuel system into a clean energy system is really hard, even with the best of intentions. It is not only the science that is hard. Once we have a clean technology breakthrough, building the transmission lines that can be integrated into a smart grid can be excruciatingly difficult. Just ask the folks at Southern California Edison, who have more renewable power in their arsenal than any utility in the world. What is it like, I asked their leadership team, to add just one wind farm to their power mix? It sounds great, right? Let's add some wind. One little wind farm. No problem. Do you have 11 years? Here's the story. Thanks to California's renewable energy mandate, lots of people have invested in wind power in that state. The only problem is that the places where the wind blows the hardest and longest, and where you can put the wind turbines while disturbing the fewest people, are far away from major cities. Because SoCalEd wanted to buy wind in bulk, it had to erect a new $2 billion power transmission line from the big new wind farms in the Tehachapi Pass north of Edwards Air Force Base over to Los Angeles. Distance? 275 miles of power lines. The first hurdle was transmission planning, which is known as the interconnection study process. This process includes a finding of need for the new line, what route it will take, and, most important, who will pay for it. In SoCalEd's case, the process triggered a fight over how much of the new line was really for carrying renewable wind power and how much was just to improve the reliability of the grid and who should pay for each piece. Everyone got a chop at this process, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the California Independent System Operator, a not-for-profit public benefit corporation charged with operating the majority of California's high-voltage wholesale power grid. This review was an open process, and all the wind owners came forward with their maps of where the transmission line should run and how much they should pay. After months of that fight, said Ron Litzinger, Senior Vice President for Transmission and Distribution for Southern California Edison, we finally said, look, we'll pay for it all, as public policy support will likely ensure investment recovery. Would everyone now please put their pencils down so that we can proceed? Then the fun starts. It takes you 2 years to get through the study process, said Litzinger. Then you have a year to do an environmental survey along the route to study what vegetation grows there and what endangered species you might run into. Then you have 1.5 to 2 years with the Public Utilities Commission. They reconfirm the finding of need and review our environmental assessment and hire another contractor to do an independent environmental review. We also have to go through some federal land, and that is always a problem because Then you have to get a separate permit from the particular federal land agency. State and federal law are not in sync on this, so the National Forest person says, I don't want a transmission line going through my forest. We had to work that out, too. Then we had to present an environmental mitigation plan for how we intended to mitigate the damage along the route. Only after that was accepted could the whole thing go ahead. On a good day, a transmission line will take 5 years from the start of the process until you have the permit and the route in hand. All these reviews are important. You can't be an environmentalist and disdain them, but you can't be an environmentalist anymore either without wanting to find a way to streamline them so the right projects get built in real time. The construction itself takes only 2 years, less than half the time it takes to get the permits. We have about 4,500 megawatts in Tehachapi we can draw on, said Litzinger. We started the project in 2002, and today, February 25, 2008, we have permits for one-third of the project in hand. We started construction on January 3, 2008, and we hope to be delivering some power, about 700 megawatts, to homes in the Los Angeles basin by 2009. The whole thing will be permitted and constructed and fully operational by 2013. 11 years in the making. 11 years to fully connect one wind farm. I don't think that timetable is going to cut it in a world where every 2 weeks China opens new coal-fired power plants big enough to serve all the households in my hometown of Minneapolis. Yes, you say, it's relatively easy to build dirty coal plants. And you are right. It's much more difficult to build power plants that are clean and super efficient. Right now, China is mainly putting up dirty ones. But soon, they will be putting up wind farms, solar facilities, and nuclear plants with the same relentless efficiency. You can bet your house on it. It will take time, but they will eventually try to outgreen us. They'll have to, or they won't be able to breathe. And what about us? Will we step up our game? We can't be China for a day, and we should not have to, and we should not want to. But it is a measure of how incoherent, ad hoc, and asystematic American energy policy is right now that such fantasies flash into your mind. If we cannot find a way to overcome all of these weaknesses and chart an intelligently designed energy strategy, our generation had better brace itself for a rocky retirement and some really unpleasant questions from our kids. I have always believed, said Jeffrey Immelt, that every generation looks back at the generation before it and has one big question about something they did or did not do. For our generation, the big question to the generation before us was, how could good people be so prejudiced against blacks or women? I am convinced that when our kids are 50 and they look back at us, they are going to ask us, what were you thinking? You were the richest country in the world. You had the technology to really make a difference on things like global warming. Why were you so slow to do the right things? They are going to say, gosh, what were you doing? Chapter 17. A Democratic China or a Banana Republic? So, what were we doing to change the world in the years when we were the world's only superpower? Actually, that's a question our children are already asking. They have been asking it for a while. In July 2007, I took part in a green technology conference in Colorado that brought together some of the world's top energy innovators and scientists under the auspices of Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield & Byers, the venture capital firm. It was a stimulating, often deeply technical discussion led by climate and energy experts. At the close of the conference, Our hosts said they wanted to show an old news clip. Up on the screen came a slightly grainy video from the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. A 12-year-old girl from Canada named Severin Suzuki was addressing the plenary session of the Rio Summit. The camera would occasionally pan to the audience of environment ministers from all over the world who could be seen listening to her every word with rapt attention, as we did. Suzuki's speech is one of the most eloquent statements I have ever heard about both the strategic and the moral purpose of a real green revolution at the dawn of the energy climate era, from anyone of any age. Here is an excerpt. Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki, speaking for ECO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We are a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Suddy, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We raised all the money to come here 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in the ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day, vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies, but now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry about these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions, but I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forests that once grew where there is now desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Don't forget why you're attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world, and we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you. Please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you. Every time I listen to that speech, I get a little chill, especially from the line, you are what you do, not what you say. For me, the beauty, power, and virtue of Suzuki's words is in their raw reminder of what a real green revolution is all about. It is not about Earth Day concerts. It is not about special green issues of magazines. It is not about 205 easy ways to go green. It is not just the latest dot-com gold rush or marketing fad either. It is a survival strategy. It is about what we do in response to the truly massive challenge that we face to preserve the natural world that has been bequeathed to us. Somewhere along the way, that larger purpose has gotten lost. Too often and in too many ways, green has become a license to feel good without doing good, to raise awareness without actually changing our behavior. People often ask, "I want to be green. How can I make a difference?" My answer is always twofold. First, pay attention and personally lead as environmentally sustainable a life as you can. Nobody is perfect. I'm sure not. But just make sure your own environmental awareness and behavior is always a work in progress. That is vitally necessary, but it is not sufficient. Whatever personal commitments you, your kids, or your neighbors make, we as a society need to translate them into national and international commitments by institutionalizing them in laws, regulations, and treaties. And that leads to my other answer. It is much more important to change your leaders than your light bulbs. Leaders write the rules and regulations, and the rules and regulations shape markets and change the behavior and incentives of millions of people at once. Leaders write the rules for how efficient your light bulbs have to be, whether you turn the lights on or remember to shut them off. They write the rules for how many miles your car has to get per gallon, whether you buy a Prius or a Hummer. They write the rules for how much clean power your utility has to buy, whether its CEO is progressive or Neanderthal. They write the rules for how efficient your air conditioner has to be, whether you can afford to run it or not. They write the rules for whether a transmission line for clean power can cut across your property or can be held up in legal battles for a decade. They write the rules about what tax incentives Congress will offer, or not, to developers of wind, biomass, and solar power. They write the rules for what kind of carbon tax will be assessed to shape the market. They write the rules for how high or low the cap in cap and trade will be. They write the regulations that ban plastic shopping bags, lower speed limits, restrict where biofuel crops can be planted, and determine whether utilities are compensated for encouraging you to consume electricity or to save it. But how do we, as a society, give rise to leaders who will write the right rules? Where do they come from? And how can we, as a society, demand that they really get it right? Those are the critical questions I want to try to answer in this concluding chapter. For starters, the Green Revolution should look to two precedents: the Civil Rights Movement and America's mobilization to fight World War II. The Green Revolution is similar to the Civil Rights Movement in that it is about personal virtue, but does not stop at personal virtue. The Civil Rights Movement forced white Americans to treat black Americans the way they themselves would want to be treated. But it was not just about asking people to be nice to a new African American neighbor or to voluntarily open up the membership of the local swimming club. Ultimately, it was about changing laws so that no one had an option to discriminate. And it was those laws that ultimately changed the behavior and consciousness of tens of millions of people. But the civil rights movement started with citizen activism, the black activists who were ready to sit down at the all-white lunch counter, the ones who refused to go to the back of the bus or give up their seats to white people, the ones who defied racists and walked through the front gates of Ole Miss or the University of Georgia. Their example and courage inspired others. And eventually that movement built and reached a crescendo, with a million people listening to Martin Luther King Jr. deliver the "I Have a Dream" speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to a crowd stretching all the way down the National Mall on August 28, 1963. This combination of activism and inspiration motivated others, and slowly the country became aware that something had to be done. that the status quo was no longer tolerable because it would no longer be tolerated. Eventually, these protests and the sheer number of protesters attracted the attention of local, state, and federal lawmakers, many of whom, though long aware of segregation and aware that the majority of the country didn't like it, took the view that changing things would be more trouble than keeping the status quo. But seeing that